Commission on Human Rights, HIV and Sex Work Policy. My name's Andrew Hunter. I work with the Asia Pacific Network of Sex Workers. And I was the point person for organising this non-abstract session. The idea of this session is to give people an overview of how we've ended up where we are in terms of the mess that is sex work policy globally around HIV/AIDS. I've got a brief introductory presentation which I'll show you, which will set the scene for what the other speakers are talking about. With me on this very diverse panel from many regions of the world, we have Gulnara, who is from Kyrgyzstan, who is a PCB alternate rep for the NGO delegation, and she'll be talking to us about the development of the UNAIDS HIV/AIDS guidance note on sex work, and elaborating on some of the issues we've had with that. We have Alejandra Gil from Apruase in Mexico City, who have been the organizers of the sex work events here in the conference, and they are the focal point for RetroSex, which is the Latin American network of sex workers for Mexico. We have Dorothy Akinova from Nigeria, who will be speaking on issues in relation to how this affects sex workers in an African context, and also some other points of view. We have Heijin Kim, who is a late addition to our panel, who is going to give us some background on the situation in South Korea, where an anti-trafficking law was passed a few years ago, and tell us the impact that that's had 4 years on, which should be interesting. We have Mina Seshu, who is going to give us a view on how these policies actually impact people on the ground, and is also going to do a summary. And we also have, up after Gulnara, a film by Chatchai Kongmont. Where is he? Dale from APNSW. And this is, we've been showing a film of his on the trafficking laws in Cambodia around the place, this conference. This is a new film, and this is the first time it will be shown, and that will be after Gulnara. So I'll do the overview presentation, I think. Yes. Back. Okay. So for many years, the UN policy on sex work had developed to be quite supportive, and you can see from this quote that the policy environment was encouraging sex worker empowerment and was encouraging governments to look at decriminalization of sex work. Then in 2001, Sweden passed a law which made it illegal to buy sex. The rationale for this law was that by stopping demand for prostitution, they could eradicate prostitution. Several other countries have followed with this, and India is looking at doing it this year. Then, in 2002, the US government adopted an anti-prostitution position. First, it applied to anti-trafficking grants and said that no organisation that supported sex workers' law reform could actually get grants for anti-trafficking programs. And this was the first time, and it was in a presidential national security directive, that they declared that prostitution fuels trafficking. And so this new position of the US government came to the fore. And it's sort of an old position, but it was an old position of a fringe of an extreme right-wing weirdo section of the feminist movement, basically, and then it moved into the mainstream. But we've seen a lot of that with governments in the last 8 years, weirdo right-wing thinking moving into the mainstream. Then in 2003, Laura Bush launched the Global War on Trafficking. And they made these statements that where prostitution is legalized or tolerated, there is a greater demand for human trafficking, and used this as a justification for eradicating the sex industry globally. publications like this were put out, trying to justify the link between prostitution and sex trafficking. And over the years, it started off saying that prostitution fueled trafficking. We've seen a closing of that gap to the point where now prostitution is sex trafficking. It's like there's no distinction. Then in 2004, we had the PEPFAR legislation, where these positions were applied to all USAID grants in relation to HIV. And what they did was it didn't just apply to organisations own PEPFAR grants. An organisation who signed this policy could not use any other money it raised to work on prostitutes' rights-related activities. So it applied to all funds of any organisation that got US money. So then in 2005, UNFPA became the lead agency in UNAIDS dealing with sex work. It actually doesn't say that. It gives a list of every group, of every risk group UNFPA doesn't work with. And if you had a list of all the risk groups you can think of, it leaves sex workers. It was a point where the UN weren't even writing sex work. They began to develop a guidance note and held some consultations with sex worker organisations, totally ignored the input of sex worker organisations, and then released the document, and sex worker groups protested this through the UNAIDS PCB, and we managed to get a PCB directive that this be rewritten. Gulnara will elaborate on this. So here's some pictures to show us the sort of things we have as a result of these policies. We've got in Cambodia some women being rescued with cops with machine guns. We've got a nice picture of this boarded up brothel. There's streets in Cambodia that used to be red light areas. They're all like this. We have a picture of Chinese sex workers at a public shaming parade to stop prostitution and end trafficking. We've then at this point seen some other civil society actors coming in and supporting the sex worker organisations in our push to actually address this policy. And the one high light on the horizon from which we've been working for the last few months has been the Commission on AIDS in Asia report, where they recommended that after a year-long investigation into what was fueling the HIV epidemic in Asia, it was recommended that prostitution and male-to-male sex be decriminalised, and that men who have sex with men, drug users and sex workers should have full human rights. This report was accepted by the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, who put out a statement calling for the decriminalisation of prostitution. So the sex worker organisations and networks are basically calling for a bit of policy cohesion in the UN. And I think maybe we could ask them to play follow the leader and to follow the lead of the Secretary General in looking at reviewing these laws that actually impact on sex workers so much, and looking at the idea again of decriminalising prostitution. So that's the policy setting and gets us up to date on our pass to Gulnara, who is going to update us on the UNAIDS guidance note.
My name is Gulnara Kurmanova. I'm from Kyrgyzstan. Thank you, Andrew, for your presentation. I would like to present some more details about sex work and HIV guidance note. Because I think that this is a very, very clear and illustrative example of first of all, of current problems on the high policy level, and the second one, the example of involvement of sex work communities into a decision-making process. How to?
What should I do?
Sorry.
What happened?
Yeah? No? Oh, yes. Thank you. It's okay. So, about UNAIDS/UNFPA guidance note on sex work and HIV. As Andrew mentioned, the process was started in 2005 when UNFPA took leadership in sex work political, sex work related political issues. I was involved in into this process since 2006 after the global consultations with the sex workers, their alliance and other stakeholders in Rio de Janeiro. After these consultations, experts from UNFPA developed the so-called guidance note based on a three-pillar approach. And this version was focused on prostitution prevention instead of HIV prevention. And we were so surprised when we have seen this version. And I know that in 2007, on PCB UNAIDS, this version was rejected because a lot of people, not only sex workers, but a lot of their allies, were so unhappy about this guidance note. Then, later, it was redrafted by sex workers' networks. And we have two versions of guidance note. First version was developed by UNAIDS experts, who are experts, first of all, in diplomacy, and this version was based on moralistic approach. The second one was developed by sex workers, who are experts in sex work, and this version was based on human rights. From my point of view, it is too complicated to join these versions because of crucial differences in basic approaches and values. And sex workers are waiting. Past half a year, UNAIDS promises us clearly to develop a revised version soon and soon and soon and soon. And we hope, of course, that revised version will be based on human rights approach and it will be acceptable for sex workers themselves. Yes, we hope that renewed version will be useful to make sex workers' lives better. Yes, we hope that it will be impossible to use a new version of this guidance note to justify persecution of sex workers, criminalize sex work directly or indirectly as a traffic, human traffic. And especially deprive HIV-positive sex workers of antiretroviral therapy, which equals killing them. But we are so tired to listening to promises. We demand to include sex workers directly into the process of guidance note revision. We demand to create an oversight committee which includes sex workers, activists, and other people who are interested in guidance note, and include sex workers and those who will be nominated by sex workers' networks into UNFPA working group, which is responsible for this document. This is about something about our rights. Sex workers have the right to be involved meaningfully in decision-making process which influence their lives and lives of their children. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you for that update, Gulnara. It takes us right up to what we asked for yesterday. So that's fairly up to date. Now we have the video from Cambodia. This video contrasts two different approaches to sex work, both that were approved by the first version of the UN guidance note. It talks about the Cambodian 100% condom use program and the abuses under that program, and then takes us to what's happening now with the situation for Cambodian sex workers under the current anti-trafficking law, which was introduced into Cambodia in March of this year. The video goes for about 12 minutes, but I think that watching this video will give a lot more information on the situation there than just a short presentation. What's interesting about this is that Cambodian sex workers are being able to choose between these two approaches, and they're rejecting this choice. Why should they have one? Why should they choose one approach that violates their human rights over another approach which violates their human rights more? So they're asking for, proper human rights-based programs, and this video shows you the choice they've got. And the Khmer saying for this sort of dilemma where they're given two bad choices is that they're stuck between the tiger and the crocodile. So I have forgotten my instructions on how to start the video.
Sex workers in Cambodia have been fighting abuses within the country's 100% condom use program since it started. In early 2008, a new law against human trafficking was passed in Cambodia, making all sex work illegal. Now there are new types of repression as brothels are closed and sex workers are arrested and forced into rehabilitation centers. The response of the UN organizations and most international NGOs working on HIV has been to support the law, but in a way that allows the 100% condom use program to continue. Sex workers reject both the 100% condom use program and the new anti-trafficking law. This is the story of the abuses they have faced under both systems and why Cambodian sex workers are stuck between the tiger and the crocodile.
If 100%, if you talk about condom, why is it condom still being used as evidence to track the sex workers or to charge the sex workers? This still happens in many countries in Asia.
ต้นเดย์เตรอะไรอย่างเงี้ยทางการที่กฎหมายตอนนี้เรื่องที่ไม่ให้น้องผู้หญิงมาขี่พวกสาวเพศ2เองคนละเพศเดียวกันอะไรอย่างเงี้ยว่าตำรวจเนี่ยตรวจกระเป๋าน้องแล้วเจอยาเขาถือว่าพวกถุงยาแล้วก็โดนจับถุงยาแล้วก็เซ็นมันจะเป็นใช้ไปได้แหละเพราะว่าตำรวจบางนายบางพื้นที่เนี่ยต้องใช้ถุงยาเป็นตัวจับเลย
เรียกว่าโครงการถุงยางร้อยเปอร์เซ็นต์ใช่ไหมแต่ว่าร้อยเปอร์เซ็นต์เนี่ยมันไม่ได้หมายเป็นกับทั่วทุกคนใช่ไหมมันไม่ได้เท่าเทียมทุกคนก็คือไม่ได้ครอบคลุมให้กับกลุ่มแม่บ้านหรือว่ากลุ่มอะไรเพราะว่าเวลาที่เขาโฆษณาหรือว่าการใช้โครงการนี้ในการทําเนี่ยเขาจะไปลงให้กับพนักงานบริการอย่างเดียวไงตัวเดียวคือว่าไปเจาะจงตามสถานบริการเลยใช่ไหมล่ะเนาะแล้วอันนั้นเนี่ยมันก็ทําให้ว่า ให้คนในชุมชนก็คิดว่าอุ้ยผู้หญิงบริการเท่านั้นน่ะที่จะใช้คอนดอมเนี่ยแล้วถุงยางก็เลยกลายเป็นเครื่องมือที่แบบไม่ใช่เครื่องมือแพทย์แล้วเพราะคนคิดว่ามันเป็นเรื่องของการอคติใช่ไหมว่าใครที่มันพวกถุงยางคือมันเป็นคนยอมรับว่ามันเป็นคนที่มันขายบริการทางเพศอย่างเงี้ย
Police mà đang chặt nhầm nó xuồn khai chê nhầm tấu thôi sợ ông tham bệnh mê sầm phăng thở sợ ông chân xuồn nó hết hay đó tiền đài nhầm ở nhầm lần lan ខ្ញុំមិនព្រមឡើងខ្ញុំថាខ្ញុំកំហុសខុសរឿងអ្វីហើយដល់ថាខំខោអីឲ្យឡើងឡានដល់ឲ្យខ្ញុំមិនឡើងយកនាឡិកាខ្ញុំដាក់ប៉ៅខោទៅចាប់ផ្សេងផ្សេងទៀតទៅប៉ណ្ណឹងចាប់មើលមើលចាប់រាល់តែថ្ងៃបងភ័យខ្ញុំអ្នកអត់មានអីហូបបានរស់ទី3ចូលភេទម៉ែឲ្យចែកឲ្យប៉ណ្ណឹងវាថាអញ្ចឹងខ្ញុំឈឺចិត្តដែរ
ពេលខ្លះនៅពេលដែលពួកខ្ញុំមានខុនដុំមានសមណាម័យគាត់ចកតែងតែឲ្យគាត់សួរពួកខ្ញុំថាហេតុអីបានយកខុនដុំអីមកចែកអីនៅហ្នឹងខ្ញុំថាខ្ញុំចង់ដើម្បីជួយកាត់បន្ថយនៅកម្មរោគអីគាត់ថាអត់ឲ្យចែកនៅហ្នឹងទេអញ្ចឹងពេលខ្លះបើស្ត្រីខ្ញុំចែកឲ្យស្ត្រីទៀតមានខុនដុំទៀតគេជួនកាលឲ្យស្ត្រីហ្នឹងស៊ីស្រោមហ្នឹងទៀតបើឆែកទៅឃើញ
ហើយពេលនោះគឺមានម៉ូតូដុបមនុស្សដែលជិះតាមខ្នងគេឈប់មើលគេស្មានតែមានរឿងអីហើយខ្ញុំក៏ស្រែកខ្លាំងៗថាពួកខ្ញុំមិនមែនចោលណាហេតុអីក៏ចាប់ហើយពេលនោះគាត់និយាយថាថ្ងៃស្រីខូចខុសច្បាប់ក៏ឆ្លើយទៅវិញថារឿងហេតុអីក៏ថាខ្ញុំស្រីខូចខុសច្បាប់វាថាមកពីពួកថ្ងៃមានស្រោមអនាម័យខ្ញុំថាហេតុអីក៏ពេញមានស្រោមអនាម័យក្នុងខ្លួនខុសច្បាប់ចុះហេតុអីក៏រដ្ឋាភិបាលប្រកាសតាមទូទស្សន៍ឲ្យប្រើស្រោម 100% ហើយពួកខ្ញុំប្រើស្រោម 100% រឿងអីថាខុសច្បាប់ហើយស្ត្រីស្រីខូចនឹងមានច្បាប់ចែងមកពីណាថាថាស្អីមានច្បាប់ចាត់ចងដូចជាអ្នកតោសនោះ
in Cambodia the rather than testing the clients or rather than using the clientsSTI as an indication of unsafe sex in a brothel, a different approach was taken where they tested the sex workers. So there was in Cambodia there was a requirement that all sex workers, all registered sex workers, would attend an STI clinic once a month. That was a mandatory requirement and have a mandatory HIV test. So that meant that in some of the locations that we looked at, maybe only 50% of the sex workers were registered. So the whole monitoring mechanism was flawed. And so the program logic sounds all very neat and sensible, but the reality of the world, and particularly the reality of the world of sex work, is that it basically doesn't work because there are too many internal flaws in the logic that
ហើយគេម
ានដឹង
ថាតើអ្នកដែលមានទុកមេរោគចឹងត្រូវការឆ្នាំជាបាជាបន្តណា
ចា
មានគិតដល់ពីចំណុចហ្នឹងដែរ
អត់គិតទេបើគិតមែនដល់សោកលុយអានលែងទេហើយជឺខ្ញុំអត់ឆ្នាំលែងទៀតគេឲ្យអនុប្រធានថាត្រូវតលែងគេអត់អាចយកម្នាក់ហ្នឹងមកឯងគេមកពេញមើលខ្លួនតែចឹងហ្នឹងតែព្រមលែងខ្ញុំទៀត
បងបានទទួលឆ្នាំពីជីវិតហើយ
ទៅបានហើយ
បងបានទទួលពីខាងណាដែរ
ខាងឃ្លីននេះចឹងមួយឆ្នាំហើយបានរត់ទៅដល់ទីពេទ្យពេទ្យជាបាលអត់អស់លុយទេពេទ្យជួយពេទ្យឃ្លីនិកគុំ
4ថ្ងៃខ្ញុំស្គើអញ្ចឹងស្គើប្អួតខ្ញុំហាងក្រុមពួកខ្ញុំនឹងសឹកគ្នាថាស្គើអញ្ចឹងស្គើប្អួតចេញបើយើងចេញមិនហួរគឺគេវាយយើងងាប់ដែរព្រោះហើយខ្ញុំចូលក្នុងពីសាហើយតាំងខ្ញុំចូលមុនដំបូងខ្ញុំពោះធំបានប្រហែល7ខែចូលក្បាលខែ8ជូ8ខែហ្នឹងគេបាយជ្រូកហ្នឹងបងហើយពេលនៅក្នុងហ្នឹងជូអាចក្នុងហ្នឹងដេកទឹកនោមទៀតហ
ើយចឹងណាគេមកកោតអាចកោតទឹកនោមទៅ
ពួកខ្ញុំហ្នឹងគេប្រើពួកផផងឲ្យចាក់អាចចេញហ្នឹងពេលដែរខ្ញុំរត់ហ្នឹងគេថាស្អែកហ្នឹងគឺអស់អត់មានទឹកផឹកអត់មានបាយហូបគឺអស់ទឹកហ្មងណាអស់ទឹកពួកខ្ញុំក៏ចាត់ការកើនទៀងប្អួនដងតិចដងតិចរងបានចេញកើតាដូចមែនកើតាទេបងគុកហ្មងបើយកគេ
បងយ
កតែ
គលិពួកខ្ញុំនឹង
បង
បា
ទពួកខ្ញុំខាង
ខ្ញុំរកគេ
ខ្ញុំរកគេខ្ញុំ
ទៀតបងបងសឹកគ្នាពួកខ្ញុំ
អូស្រីនេះតែក៏ពួកខ្ញុំត្រាការគ្រប់គ្រង
បើស្រីស្រស់នឹងសក់វែងគឺគេចាប់កាត់សក់អញ្ចឹងគ្នាត្រូវមានបន្លាស់ពីរពេលថ្ងៃគ្នាត្រូវដោះសក់ចេញពីក្បាលតួអង្គជា MSM ពេលយប់គ្នានឹងកែងខ្លួនជា Transgender ដើម្បីមកលុបភេទបដូរយលុយអញ្ចឹងការដែលផ្ដាល់ព័ត៌មានចេញពីស្រីស្រស់គឺថាមានផលប៉ះពាល់ច្រើនមែនទែនរហូតប៉ូលីសចាប់យកទៅឆក់នឹងខ្សែភ្លើងអាពិលប្រចាំសម្រាប់ឆក់បោះប៉ូលីសហ្នឹងគឺប្រើអំពើហិង្សាមកលើក្រុម Transgender ច្រើនមែនទែនក្នុងខេត្តសៀមរាប
ធម្មតាប៉ូលីសជួនកាលគេចោះមកចាប់បើថាចាប់បានម្នាក់អញ្ចឹងហើយពួកខ្ញុំត្រូវតែរត់កិច្ចបើតែជាអត់រត់កិច្ចជួយគ្នាអញ្ចឹងគឺគេពាត់ចាប់ទាំងអស់ពួកយើងច្រើនជាងហ្នឹងប៉ុន្តែធ្វើម៉េចបងមកគេចោះមកគេឆក់យើងអញ្ចឹងឆក់យើងហើយនឹងថ្ងៃគេមានដបងឆក់ឬមួយក៏បាក់ភ្លើងអីទៅបើតែជាយើងរត់គឺគេបានយើងបើតែជាយើងឈោអញ្ចឹងយើងអត់ព្រមទៅជាមួយគេគេឆក់យើងក៏គេឆក់យើងហើយឬគេចាក់យើងគេដាក់ឡានត្រង់ទៅបាត់អញ្ចឹងណាបងគេនិយាយចាំតាំងនៅនឹងគេមកឲ្យយើងរកទីផ្លូវផែ
ហេតុអីបង
ខ្ញុំមិនដឹងដែរ
គេគិតថាខ្ញុំខុសច្បាប់ហើយ
ចាខ្ញុំមិនដឹងដែរប៉ុន្តែធម្មតាបាត់ទៅបើដូចជាពួកប្រភេទខ្ញុំអីគឺថាចាក់រកទីផ្លូវច្បាស់អញ្ចឹងអត់រកទីផ្លូវផែអញ្ចឹងគឺអត់មានអីចាំខ្លួនពួកថាអត់ទៅឆ្ងាយឆ្ងាយ
តាមប៉ាត់គេបាត់មែនតើហ្មងគេមានបាត់លេងលេងគេបាត់មកច្រាស់ហ្នឹងគេបាត់ទាំងអស់ហ្មងប្រហែលជាចិត្តចូលមួយខែនេះលឺបាត់ហ្នឹងចូលមួយខែហ្មងហើយប៉ុន្តែដូចថាអ្នកខ្លះគ្នានៅស្រុកឆ្ងាយជាងគ្នាអត់មានកន្លែងនៅជាងគ្នាដូចថារកកន្លែងទៅអត់ទាន់បានអញ្ចឹងនៅជាទ្រាំនៅសិនទៅហើយគេដេញនិយាយដែរដូចថាគ្នាជាទ្រាំទៅដូចថាគ្នាមកពីស្រុកឆ្ងាយដូចថាវាអត់មានផ្ទះមានស្បែងនៅហ្នឹងអញ្ចឹងហើយរកកន្លែងស្នាក់នៅអត់ទាន់បានហើយគ្នាជានៅសិនទៅបើតាមតែគេដេញតាំងពីមួយខែមុនតោះក្នុងពោចឹងហ្មងចង់ឲ្យគេបាត់ហាងដូចថាចេះអ្នកខ្លះគ្នាក្រអត់មានសមត្ថភាពអ្នកខ្លះចឹងទៅមានផ្ទុកមានរោគគ្នារស់ស៊ីអីកើតចឹងមានអាមុខល្អប៉ុណ្ណឹងហើយបបាត់គ្នាតិចមិនចោលគ្នាទេទៅរស់ស៊ីបានឲ្យគ្នាមានមុខល្អប៉ុណ្ណឹងក្នុងពោតែប៉ុណ្ណឹងបានហើយ
See the problem with raids is that you have the people who want to rescue women and children who are in prostitution using the oppressive arms of the state, the most oppressive arm of the state, which is the police, to conduct this rescue operation through a raid. The raid, of course, is conducted under tremendous human rights violations. And the community is never, ever going to respond to anybody who's bringing in the police to rescue them, because they do not view that as a rescue. They view that as another oppressive thing that's done to them. So if you really actually want to talk about people who do not want to be in sex work, the best strategy is to actually have a conversation with them, have empower the community such that you create an environment that people who do not want to be there can actually say they don't want to be there and have processes where they can leave, and people who want to be there live there with dignity. If that can just be done, which is a simple thing, generations of this oppressive raids haven't worked. We know that.
Okay, so I hope that's brought a bit of a voice of some sex workers on the ground and how these policies are actually affecting their lives. I mean, both these programs are, when you speak to governments and when you speak to officials from funding agencies and from the UN, they use the UNAIDS draft guidance note as a justification for it. The 100% condom use approach of using the police to enforce safe sex is in the guidance note, and so is the idea of eradicating the sex industry. And secondly, the other thing is that it's the lack of there being any finalized guidance note which lets are the, you know, the different co-sponsors in country, those agencies actually do what they like in regard to sex work policy. So we have in Cambodia, it was actually UNICEF who got the money and worked on drafting the anti-trafficking law, which led to these situations. So now I'm going to present Alejandra Gil from Mexico, who will give us a brief overview of some of the human rights situations here in Mexico and in general.
Muy buenos días, tardes a todos.
Good morning to all of you. I don't have a presentation because sometimes it's better to hear the voice of a sexual worker than to have a detailed paper. I'm Alejandra Gil. I was a former sex worker. I'm a founder of a foundation for sexual workers and focal point of intersex. All of these violations to human rights are being taking place at the world level, more in some places, less in some other, but I think that all sexual workers, men or women, and trans have been violated their rights everywhere. There are some directives passed and some other laws passed. There are promises, there are addresses saying that stigma and discrimination for the sexual work should be removed. And more there is more stigma and more discrimination. The mandatory detection test in Latin America and in many countries in the world, the only thing they do is a policy, police repression. What you saw in the video is just in one place where a condom cannot be in the pocket because that's a crime. In Mexico, we also have the same situation in many states and municipalities of Mexico. We have to talk in the context of a sexual work, and we have to get together to have one voice where the rest of the organization working with HIV would turn their gaze to us. We are included in the rest of the population, but the rest of the population do not want to see us. We are among the youngsters, among people living with HIV, in MSMs, in positive women. We are there. Do not close your eyes. We are there. We do not want to be discriminated by you. We have to be included in the prevention of HIV. Just turn your gaze toward us. Don't tell us, oh, this is because you are just sexual workers. In this context of HIV, we do not have to blame people and to look for innocence in the pandemics, because where we have culprits on innocence in that categorization, we are not going to change the overview of HIV. And these groups are culprits of the epidemic. If we are seeing like that, the strategy for the prevention of HIV will not change for the sex work. We have actions and programs in the Latin American network. All of you have actually proven that the prevention of HIV in sexual work is fundamental. And you see the low rates of HIV in sex work. So give us the opportunity. As my colleague Elena Reynada said yesterday, we are not the problem. We are part of the solution. Just give us the money so we can carry out those programs. Do not give the funds to other people that apply discriminatory policies to the sexual work. I leave the voice to my colleagues, and thank you very much for hearing me.
Thanks for that, Alejandra. You summed up the issues for sex workers really well in a very impassioned plea, and also way under time, which was fantastic, seeing I told everyone to try and be as quick as possible. So now I've got Dorothy from Nigeria.
Hi, everyone. I am supposed to be presenting on sex workers in the context of the African continent. It's a huge continent. I can't pretend to know everything that is happening within that continent, but I'll share with us the little that I know, and especially from the country from where I come. I am a feminist and a sexual rights activist based in north of Nigeria. And those who are familiar with the north of Nigeria know that it is a context where the Sharia law is in application in its full force. Sex work in Africa, before I comment on sex workers, who they are and their rights, I would want to talk a bit about how we are in the position where we are right now. And that is approaching it from the point of view of addressing the issue of trafficking. Africa is full of developing countries, very poor countries, and are dependent on the North for aid to bridge gaps in all the kind of social needs that people have within the different countries. And that makes us susceptible to the policies that are made in the North, the laws that are made in the North, because our governments are held responsible and are compelled to implement, otherwise they don't get the loans and the kind of aids that come from the North. As a continent, we provide for trafficking markets, but we are also recipients from all over the place. In Nigeria, I know that we do receive from Philippines, from Cotonou, that is Benin Republic, and some other parts of Africa, people who are trafficked into the country. And some people are also trafficked from Nigeria through Ghana, Ivory Coast, before they go up north and into Italy and France and the USA and other places. And that creates a very complex network as far as trafficking in human is concerned, and also sex trafficking in particular. So to hold any particular government responsible for what is happening and make or force their hands to stop it is very demanding on those governments, and is partly why they are pushed to do the kind of things that we have in place right now. I also want us to reflect a bit on the structural adjustment policies that were brought and imposed on our countries that caused the withdrawal of social subsidies and increase difficulty and increase poverty in the population, and therefore fueled the market as far as sex trafficking especially is concerned. As much as I know that most of our governments are reckless and are not accountable, we also would hold the international community responsible for developing policies such as the SAPs and imposing them on governments without necessarily giving them a choice. And this also creating the fertile ground for trafficking to take place, because when the campaigns began, the U.S. campaign especially, it seemed as though they didn't have a hand at all in creating the environment that exists for trafficking to take place. Now, the African governments, having come under pressure to end trafficking, started building alliances within the blocs in the continent to see how they can address what takes place within the context in which they are. In the ECOWAS region, for instance, there was a task force formed by the governments in the ECOWAS region to combat trafficking. And this ECOWAS task force compelled members to institute trafficking laws within their countries. And that is how the Nigerian government was moved to make a law on trafficking. We do have a federal level law on trafficking, which was developed and was not developed in a participatory manner. I'll give us a little brief of what happened. Once the word trafficking hit the Nigerian government and the pressure from the U.S., they quickly remembered their law on drug trafficking. And what they did was to take that law on drug trafficking and dust it up and remove everywhere there is drug trafficking and put human trafficking. And we all know that where drugs are seized, they are burnt. But when these human beings that are trafficked are returned, they are not going to be burnt. Something has to happen to those ones. But there was this huge gap because of the way that law was formulated. Some state governments that are particularly hosting vulnerable communities to trafficking also passed laws. Unfortunately, we were not quite aware of when all of these laws were being prepared and could not move in immediately to make contributions. For the law that was passed at the federal government level, for instance, a lot of activists came together and brought up input that would have made the law very friendly. But that was rejected because it was the pet project of the vice president's wife. So our input didn't go in. And what happened was treating trafficking as though it was drug trafficking. And at those state levels where the laws were passed, implicitly, prostitution became criminalized in those states. And that further pushed sex work underground. Already, it was a very bad environment for sex workers in Nigeria. The police clampdowns were very common, just like colleagues have said from other parts of the country. A lot of abuse, a lot of violence, rejection by family members, and a rush by well-meaning individuals to rehabilitate sex workers and putting the police to arrest them and force them into those places that looked more like camps than rehabilitation centers. And it became very difficult then to reach sex workers with programming on HIV/AIDS issues because they were always afraid of police clampdown. And all the time that we tried to organize them, they were very scared to come together in a particular space because they didn't know if it was a ploy for the police to come and get them. So a lot of the times it is difficult to reach sex worker communities with information, with messages, and even basic things like organizing that we witness in our Francophone Africa, because I know in Mali, for example, there is Dianaso, which is a sex workers network. In the Anglophone Africa, we do not have that. I know also that we pretend that we don't have male sex workers. And so programs that are specially designed to address the needs of male sex workers, whether they are serving male community or women clients, is missing in the continent. And lots of other consequences that we have observed from this move and campaign by the North to end trafficking and its impact on sex work is the fact that it has made migration extremely difficult. In Nigeria, to get a visa, if you are between the ages of 15 and 35, and you're female, and you don't have a job that pays well, then you are not likely to get a visa, even if you have an invitation letter saying you are going for an international AIDS conference in Canada, for instance. You may not get a visa to go there because there is this profiling of the kind of young woman that would eventually end up on the streets as a sex worker in those countries. And what has happened is the more difficult it is for people to get visas to travel, the more vulnerable they become to trafficking, and it becomes a vicious cycle because things are getting harder back home. People want to get out there to greener pastures, make better living, live in conditions where human rights are better valued, but the visas become difficult. And then the barons for trafficking come with the flamboyant promises, and then people become once more vulnerable to trafficking, and that keeps feeding itself. There is also the pretense or hypocrisy that people cannot voluntarily choose to be sex workers in the context from where I come. Many people pretend that something has to force someone to become a sex worker. Like they can't wake up. There is nothing like I have the right to choose to be a sex worker where I come from. So it is like compelling people to accept that they are being trafficked, even though they were voluntarily leaving the country to go and do sex work in another place. Is this beep for me? Okay, I see that there is a beep. If there are other issues that I haven't addressed, then when the questions come, I will address those. Thank you.
Thanks, Dorothy. It's interesting to hear your the comment you made that it's actually these things that are introduced to stop trafficking that actually fuel and create conditions where trafficking, where people actually become more vulnerable to trafficking. And we're seeing that in Cambodia as well, where someone who has had all their money taken off them by the police, who has nowhere to go, who's lost their job, whose house has been taken away, and who has no job to return to, well, if they escape or are let out of their rehabilitation centre, then the very conditions that could lead them to abusive work situations or trafficking occur. So I think that's something we need to actually focus on more, to actually showing that part of the outcomes of these sorts of repressive laws. I'll now introduce Hei Jin, who's going to give us a picture 4 years on of the situation for sex workers in Korea.
Hello everyone, I'm going to present on what we call in Korea, we refer to them as prevention acts. On the other hand, I prefer to refer them as prevention mishaps. I'm going to give you a small background on the legal situation and why these laws were implemented, and then give you an overview of the results of these laws. Before 2004, there were laws dealing with prostitution. Ironically, they were also pushed for by the United States government. These laws, while they criminalized a lot of aspects about prostitution, during the military dictatorship, they were pretty much a virtual green light for red light districts in South Korea. And as a result, we had about 70 red light districts spawning window prostitution, quite similar as in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, in South Korea. A little bit of background of the law. Between 2000 and 2004, there were several fires that happened in red light districts, and they killed several dozens of sex workers. While the majority of Korea more or less ignored these issues, several women's organizations saw this as a sign that they had to help and rescue the women who were in the sex industry. And more directly, the United States Department's 2004 Trafficking in Persons report considered Korea to be a source of destination and transit country for women trafficked for sexual exploitation. And this is actually the direct cause of this law being implemented. Women's organizations took this report up. There was pressure from the United States government for South Korea to do something about this. The result were two laws, which we call prevention acts. The first law completely redefines any form of sexual activity that involves money or any other form of compensation as sexual traffic, and then moves to criminalize any form of engaging into it, facilitating it, clients, business owners, all of it. And it only excludes victims of sexual traffic from criminalization, from punishment. So effectively, it redefines all sex workers in South Korea as victims of sexual traffic. The second act commits the government to have rehabilitation programs, exit programs. In reality, however, the government does not establish these centers themselves. They outsource them to women's organizations who have a strong anti-prostitution point of view. Mishaps. While the victims of sexual traffic, as the law defines them, should not be criminalized, the police pretty much moves into brothels, arrest clients, brothel owners, and sex workers simultaneously. So the police does not make a distinction between clients, between business owners or sex workers. It moves to arrest them all together. As a result, sex industry moved underground, moved into no forums, often less visible, and with working conditions a lot worse. They became more vulnerable, sex workers became more vulnerable to exploitation. They lost any right to speak out to themselves and claim that they were sex workers. And also as a result, both clients and sex workers in the last 4 years moved outside Korea to the United States, to Australia. A lot of Korean sex workers are working right now. And clients actually moved to other Southeast Asian countries. Sex worker response with that, we had a giant demonstration with over 3,000 sex workers in front of the National Assembly. A lot of actions happened, hunger strikes. We even formed, even the first National Sex Worker Union was formed. Unfortunately, the computer is not reading my little Korean signs. It effectively jump-started the Korean sex worker rights movement in South Korea, which was not a response that the government was expecting. To their unfortunate, but luckily for us, a lot of sex workers responded to this. Unfortunately, sex workers' voices were completely ignored. They were discredited by women's organizations, by the government for being controlled by business owners and other third parties. So if you look at the media coverage of these protests, it says 3,000 victims were forced by business owners to protest for continuation of the sex industry. This is a sort of language that was used in the media in South Korea. During the hunger strike, almost no women's organizations or any other organization in South Korea showed any solidarity. They were completely ignored. The hunger strike lasted for almost 6 months with different women participating, but ended with because nobody listened to them, nobody came to look at them, nobody came to talk to them. As a result, the sex worker union is now defunct. It didn't work because nobody listened to them, nobody talked to them. It doesn't work if sex workers are sitting among them, talking to them, then try to raise their voices, and then are completely bashed into submission. Only a small local branch remains that actually is very successful in making deals with local business owners into sort of combating the negative effects of these laws by making small deals with owners concerning the right to refuse clients, the right to use condoms, working hours, etc. Unfortunately, the local branch works in the red light district with window prostitution that is now being closed down as a result to city planning, but also as a result to continuing rhetoric through these prevention acts. Also, a new act was because clients moved outside, the Ministry of Gender Equality says, well, then we're going to not issue passports anymore to clients. So any clients who are being perceived as any clients who are being arrested or being known as clients legally are not allowed to have passports anymore. Luckily, this has proved to be completely ineffective because it's pretty much impossible to find out whether people are going to be potential clients or not. In results to HIV, the prevention acts do not take HIV in consideration, and as a result, sex work is completely invisible in any HIV policy in South Korea because it legally does not exist anymore. Legally, only sexual traffic and victims of trafficking exist. As a result, there is no prevention done for sex workers anymore. There's no policy for that anymore. And as a result, also within the sex industry, those few organizations doing outreach among sex workers can't find them anymore because they become invisible and having an extremely hard time because of the new shifts that are occurring. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Haejin. It's quite interesting to get an update of a country 4 years on from this, and I think that the fact that in any national AIDS policies, there's this idea that sex workers doesn't exist is really important for us to take on board in terms of our response to the push for these certain policies coming in other countries at the moment. I think it sounds like a bit of a disaster. But I'll leave those sorts of comments up to Mina, who is going to to give us a bit of a view from the ground, a personal view from of rescue situations. Her organisation has been targeted by a number of nice Christian organisations who want to help women, and she can also maybe provide a bit of an overview of what we've heard here today.
Hi, thanks, Andrew. I'm Meena Seshu, and I come from Sangli, which is in the western part of India. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about, because much of what everybody has said is covered in my presentation, so I, at this point in time, give it up and just speak to the point, which is, I come from an organization called Sangram, which helped collectivize sex workers, and the collective is called VAMP. And VAMP was targeted by evangelist groups coming from the U.S. They were targeted by IJM, which is the International Justice Mission, by Restore International, and by Freedom Firm. So we've had three sets of raids on the community, which has been happening since, I think, the past 3 years, or the past 4 years. And adult women have been raided, picked up and rescued, and the problem, of course, has arisen from the fact, if you can go to our website, all the information on the rescues are there, and that's www.sangram.org, so I'm not going on that. I'm talking about the fact that much of this rescuing and raiding has happened because of the conflation of prostitution, trafficking, and sexual violence. The understanding that sex work is trafficking, is sexual violence, has actually become the framework within which these raids and rescues are happening. And the other discussion, of course, is this whole issue of children in prostitution, because the understanding is that children have to be saved and rescued. And the problem that we have, of course, is, like I think it was in Gurulana's presentation yesterday, that she said that, or I don't know who it was, but anyway, that you pick up people thinking they're 16, you actually find they're 18 by medical records, and then if you ask them for birth certificates, they turn up with birth certificates of 23, 24, and it was very interesting because it is also true, I think it was Empower, it's also true that, you know, in sex work, in the sex work industry, everybody's trying to look younger. And is trying to tell everyone that they're younger because their entire clientele depends on the fact that they're younger. As all women who like to be young and young and younger, the attempt is to look younger. So you have really adult women dressing up in a much younger and attractive manner, which they think attractive, and that is attracting all this attention to the fact that they're children, because in the raids that happened in Sangli, 34 women were picked up, only four of them were actually minors, two of them were school-going children who had come to attend during the summer holidays, who had come to stay with their parents, their mothers, and two of them were real minors. And this huge, big, tremendously violating of every kind of human right raid that was conducted on these sex workers who were adults was very unfortunate. What we want, all of us, is decriminalization of sex work, recognition of sex work as work, stop conflating sex work and trafficking. Sex work is not trafficking. Stop infantilizing adults in sex work by talking about children in sex work. We know trafficking happens for many reasons. Mail order brides, begging for organs, domestic work. Sex work is one such site. Most of this trafficking, which includes kidnapping, deceit, force, into debt bondage and slavery-like practice, has to be combated. We are all part of that fight. All of us who are fighting for the rights of sex workers are very clear that trafficking should stop. Sex workers have repeatedly told state and society that they have the solutions. They know the route and the persons who are involved in trafficking. But we need a decriminalized space to help state and society fight trafficking, which unfortunately is being denied us. Stigma, judgmental attitudes keep sex workers from reaching out. And I must talk about one word about the debate on choice and force, because it has always been so interesting for me. Most adult women are considered, in sex work, are considered foolish, people who do not understand their realities, people who cannot pick up the best possible options available to them. And that is very hurtful. Women can and know how to choose the best possible option for them. Choice, of course, in the third world context, I think, is a very cruel word. We should, I would advocate that we should stop using the construct of choice, because it's not like there are these 10 nice ice creams and I can choose one and say, wow, that's the ice cream I want. Because that's not the reality of the third world. That's not the reality where most of the women come from. We need to create better realities so that women can consent to be in sex work with dignity. The other thing that I'd like to talk about is in wherever sex work is criminalized, because we keep forgetting that. In many countries in the world today, sex work is criminalized. But sex workers, even if it's criminalized, sex workers have human rights. Why are we not accepting that? I agree that, okay, in a certain particular town or in a particular state, in a particular nation, sex work is criminalized. But they still have human rights. The point is that we keep forgetting about it. I have talked to human rights activists who advocate for the rights of people who are criminalized. And I'm saying, why can't we advocate for the rights of sex workers who are also who are so deeply criminalized? Somehow that thinking is not getting reflected. And I end with two statements from WAMP, which is the collective that I come from. We are very clear. Stop saving us from saviors. We really save us. We need to be saved from saviors. We are tired of being saved and rescued and rehabilitated. We believe rehabilitation is redundant. We need to recognize rights. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mina, for that presentation and for giving that sort of summary of what's been said here. Like you said, most of the points have been made. We've got about 20 minutes. There's one microphone over here. If there are any short questions or short comments, I'd welcome people to make them.
Okay. Creo que algo que tenemos que poner sobre la mesa es que lo que se está criminalizando no es el trabajo sexual.
What's been criminalized is not sexual work. It's the sexual work that's seen. Just to begin with, why? Because we have become a global society, hypocritical. On the one hand, we're not providing all the opportunities to... Hopefully, all the workers will be able to dedicate themselves on a vocational form, sex workers we're talking about. But as a society, we are backing up a permanent exploitation, which we try to hide it. Why are we trying to do this? To try to take care of our consciousness.
I wrote my question down because I tend to ramble. My name is Nicholas. I'm from Canada. I want to thank you for such an insightful panel. As a male sex worker, I'm surprised that we haven't heard today from a sex worker who self-identifies as male. And I also attended the panel on Tuesday, Male and Transgender Sex Workers, which I think was incorrectly titled. I was disappointed that we didn't hear from a male-identified sex worker that day speaking about their own lived experiences. So I'd like to ask the panel, what does this human rights movement have to gain by ensuring we include the voices of male-identified sex workers?
Okay, I think we have a lot to gain. I think that in APNSW and most of the groups and networks, there's a big push to make it clear that these rights relate to male, female, and transgender sex workers. As the replacement chair, I worked as a sex worker a very, very long time ago, and don't lay claim to that as part of my CV anymore. I can hardly remember. But I think it's important, and I think especially in that panel you mentioned, I think that if we have a panel that was an abstract session, if you know, we pushed really hard for that session to actually include male and transgender sex workers, and I think that's something that can maybe go in the report notes from this session, that if sessions actually name populations, then the people who are actually reviewing abstracts for them need to actually look at their title and who it's looking at and actually include those issues and those people. Yes.
In fact, that's the problem we have with the UNAIDS, the draft UNAIDS guidance note. It does not talk about transgender sex workers and male sex workers as I think it should. It's absolutely imperative that the guidance note addresses sex workers, male, female, and transgender. And the draft guidance note that is out from UNAIDS does not do that.
And Alejandra, briefly.
Sí, muy breve.
The problem that we have in Latin America is that although the networks and movements, we want to include the male sex workers, you know what? They don't make themselves visible in Latin America. They'll say, oh, gosh, no, this is just, I'm doing this only momentarily to pay my rent this month or to finish paying off my car this month or something silly this month like that. We can't talk on your behalf. You got to come out.
Alejandra, I didn't get it. The translation isn't working, but I'm sure it was the right thing to say. So now, Tripti.
Hi, my name is Tripti. I'm with the Lawyers Collective in India. I have a couple of comments. Firstly, we've heard very strongly that the UN guidance note is flawed on many counts. And most importantly, I think it is based on wrong epidemiology, bad science, and a complete denial of evidence. We've been hearing this throughout, base everything on evidence, but the guidance note just makes a mess of everything that we've heard and seen so far. So I question the wisdom that calls for a revision of the guidance note rather than an outright rejection. And I'd like responses from people who are involved in this on that. We've said and heard a lot about UNFPA and what they've been doing. I don't know how many people are aware, but I'd like you to alert you to what another UN agency has been doing on human trafficking. And I'm glad Dorothy brought out the issue of drug trafficking. As many of you may know, the UNODC has received billions of US dollars for a project called GIFT, Global Initiative to Fight Human Trafficking. And we are beginning to see the effects. I don't know if anyone is here from the UNODC. Maybe they want to respond to this. In my country, in India, the UNODC has been training law enforcement, training police to go and conduct raids, to persecute, to arrest sex workers. And they do this through all sorts of means, by giving laptops, you know, police vans, cars, cell phones, you name it, all the equipment that the police really love. And I would like to alert everyone to this development and, you know, perhaps take this on in the sex work rights movement as well. Thirdly, I want to also, I know some, Andrew mentioned India and our struggle with a new law, which is a proposal to criminalize clients. And I was really horrified to hear that in Africa, sex workers or rights activists were not aware of legislative amendments being proposed, or that in Korea, for lack of support or media discrediting, you guys lost out. And I'd really like to take this moment to salute the resilience and courage of Indian sex workers who have been struggling against this law for the last 3 years. And now we've had such a situation that our Minister of Health and several other ministers are talking what sex workers have been saying, that this is a bad law, and have given us an assurance that it will not come through. So I thought it's something to bring.
Okay, firstly, any quick responses on the first point, which was about revise or reject the UN guidance note. Well, Nara said, I want to speak on that.
Thank you. Thank you for your remark on guidance note. I would add something in line with your words. First of all, I am sure that there are no obvious evidence and no good data which could be used to as a basis for previous version of guidance note. But this is not only a question about guidance note. This is a very specific question about quality of data and quality on research and about the participation of sex workers and data collection, interpretation and dissemination of results. This is a very specific issue, but I would like to mention it here because sex workers has also have right to participate in all researches, especially in this type of researches, which will be a basis for political documents on a very high level. I would like to discuss it later, maybe again.
Okay,
yeah,
Mina.
Especially on the UNAIDS guidance note. This was a discussion that was happening among networks of sex workers in the Global Working Group on Sex Work and HIV Policy. And the decision was that instead of asking them, we were definitely asking them to withdraw the present UN guidance note. We definitely asked for that. But what we did, because we believed that it is better to write up an alternative one that is coming from the point of view of sex workers' rights advocates. And that's why the entire guidance note was rewritten. There we took a political decision to keep it in the same format as the UNAIDS draft guidance note that they put out. Okay. Now, there could be a difference of opinion on whether that was a good decision or not. I can't hear you, Tripti, unless you get onto the mic. Because just unnecessarily ventilating doesn't help. Go on the mic and tell us.
Look, this discussion's happened back and forth
it's
for a long time.
It's happened back and forth. I mean, it's not something that happened entirely on its own. And it was a decision taken by everybody that we are capable of writing a guidance note for the UNAIDS, and we are capable of writing a good one, which I think we did, and presented to UNAIDS in Delhi. And the point is that we can always have discussions on maybe we missed a few points here and there. But to be able to tell UNAIDS that sex workers have the ability to write a guidance note which is in line with the rights-based approach. And I think that's what we tried to do.
Okay, next comment or question, please.
Hi, my name is Laura Cobb and I work with the CDC in Vietnam. And my question is just quickly, Mina, you mentioned at the end of your talk that you advocate for decriminalization of sex work. And I'm just wondering if, in your view, decriminalization is different than legalization. And if so, why are you advocating for decriminalization instead of legalization?
Mm-hmm. We listen to everything and then think.
Okay, thank you. I'm Noi Hapisuk. I'm from Empower Thailand. We are a sex workers organization in Thailand and we work in Mekong region with six countries along Mekong River. I'd like to thank the panel that we have a lot of vision of the common issues about human trafficking as well as in Thailand. Thai government promoting anti-trafficking law. Very recently, last August, 6th August, and their action raiding every day, and that their sex workers are put in their rehabilitation program. But my question today, I'd like to point on the universal action, that how do we respond on that? We realize that the ABC programs trying to stop people to have sex, that does not stop AIDS. And secondly, anti-trafficking law, which is directly anti-people who sell sex, that anti-people who are professional sex educator. So how do we respond in that, and how do we move on that strategically?
Hello, thank you for all the really great, insightful comments by the speakers. I'm Stephanie Sterling. I'm from New York University. I just had a quick question on the premise that trafficking is linked to legalized prostitution, and maybe has there been anything that's really shown proof to that premise, or is all of this just based on people's own beliefs that have now unfortunately been put into a lot of laws and policies?
Hola. Quiero preguntarle a la compañera que habló de último. Hablabas de las trabajadoras sexuales. Quiero saber si no se incluye las trans trabajadoras sexuales también en su país. Quiero hacer una pregunta sobre eso.
Bien, parece que el no está funcionando los aparatos.
Congratulations on your courage in presenting. I'm Claire. I'm from Canada, and I just have a question, though. I just wonder, I know all of you have kind of chosen to work in the area of sex work, and that many women do choose that as a job, but I can't help but think of the many women who don't choose sex work or who are coerced into sex work, and what and the implications, I guess, for them in terms of decriminalization or even legalization of sex work, if you could just maybe touch on how those women would be impacted. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. I think if we're going to get some responses, that we'll have to call at the end of the questions. We've got a little less than 10... We've got about 7 minutes left. Maybe, Mina, you were asked about decriminalization versus legalization, and maybe that last question as well.
Okay. Actually, you wanted to say something. No, say it. Andrew, he wanted to say something.
I can't see from here.
I wanted to quickly comment on two things. First of all, the last comment that was made on the impact that this has on people who don't give consent, to people who are forced still to work in the sex industry. What you see in South Korea is that such raids, such crackdowns by the police, they don't benefit any person which is coerced either. These people are put on the same line, they're treated with the same disrespect, with the same violence from the cops. Personally, I believe that in a decriminalized center where there's empowerment, where there are programs to empower sex workers to make their own choices, to improve their own lives, sex workers who are forced can more easily speak out about that they're forced, that they want to stop. And I personally believe that any rehabilitation programs that are solely focusing on victimization are flawed in a way that they do not address the reality that these women face, and these women or male or transgender people face in the sex industry überhaupt. I also wanted to comment on the difference between with legalization. What you see in South Korea is that there's a push for decriminalization by sex workers for the sheer fact that if a legalized system is put up, the corruption of the police does not necessarily ensure that regulations are made together with sex workers and with the involvement of sex workers.
Alejandra.
Creo que no está funcionando. No, no está. Can you hear the
los traficantes de personas.
Can you hear the translation? No, no están oyendo nada. Ya le hemos cambiado y no están oyendo nada. Can you hear the translation? No, no están oyendo nada. Can you hear the translation? No, no están oyendo nada, eh? Please raise your hand if you can hear the translation. Can you hear the translation? Hello? No, they're not listening. Only you are. Oh, okay, good. Anyway, we are not the people traffickers. Please don't use that as a pretext to draft laws against us. I don't know what's going on up there. I really apologize anyway.
Okay, the first comment will be to say one or two things on why the women's rights activists missed out on the trafficking law that was developed. This happened in 1999 and 2000. Nigeria had just become a democratic country at that time. The mechanism on how the democracy was going to work in terms of law formulation was not clearly spelled out, defined, and people weren't educated at the time on it. And before we knew it, as a result of pressure that the government was under, they hurried through making those laws. It is very different now. It wouldn't happen. It won't happen ever again. Because we are alert, we know, you know, what is happening in terms of formulation, we know the areas of intervention, and we do. What we have done is to produce a document to say these are the gaps that are existing in the existing law and asking for revision. But also in the bill on violence against women, we also have made a section addressing the gaps. And secondly, to support what the colleague just said from Korea, there are no interventions that are going on right now that are beneficial to those who are coerced. Because when persons that are perceived to have been trafficked are brought back to Nigeria, we see the kind of degrading treatment they go through. They are not treated with any dignity. They are shamed before the media. They are forced to take HIV tests, and these HIV tests are publicized. They are not treated with any confidentiality. There are no ways of ensuring that they pick up life from where they were. And sometimes when they are deported, they are not all persons who are trafficked. Sometimes there are people who just left and were doing honorable jobs, but because somebody whom they quarreled with gave police tip-up, they are picked up and also deported. And they lose their job suddenly and are back to a country and they don't even know where to start from. And like I said before, the ways that the global arena is seeking to address this is only creating more avenues for trafficking and creating more avenues for people to make choices that they are trying to wipe out.
Okay, so that's all the time. That's all we've got time for, and I'm going to try and.
Oh. I should take just that one question.
Sorry, I can't see you, Hajan.
Sorry.
Leaning forward. Go, Mina.
Yeah, just this one. This decriminalization versus legalization. The reason why the sex work rights advocates are asking for decriminalization is because in all the various models of legalization that we have seen in the world today, we have not been able to have a model that will actually include sex workers from all kinds of sex work. What is happening is that we have a lot of sex workers who are hidden, who do not want to be identified as sex workers, who want to continue to be in sex work, and we want to respect that. The legalized regime actually expects a kind of registration of sex workers in with the state, and to get state, and of course the second part was that when we had these discussions in WAMP, was that do we go to the state and ask the state to allow us to be sex workers? And I think that was the thing that was a major discussion, saying that we do not want state interference. We don't want licensing. We don't want zoning. We don't want mandatory health checkups. And we believe that the legalized setup would expect that. And also, of course, in an extreme case, taxing. So so there was a lot of discussion about legalization. The reason why we chose decriminalization was we needed to have a situation where people who are in sex work are not criminals and therefore can go to the state in cases of violence against them. If you're looking at people who do not choose to be in prostitution, who do not choose to be in sex work, we really need good strategies that will open up these spaces such that people who do not want to be there can actually reach out to both activists and arms of the state that would help them access justice. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so a couple of announcements. There's the human rights rally on at 1:30 in the Global Village. There are a number of speakers. Some of you might be interested to hear Dr. Piot's comments on human rights and might like to ask him about his view of sex workers' human rights at that rally. That would be encouraged from the chair. And also there's a resource called Our Lives Matter, which Rachel over here has some copies of and which you can pick up from the Human Rights Networking Zone and the Sex Workers Networking Zone in the Global Village. Thank you for coming. And when you hear the words trafficking, realize they're probably just anti-sex people.